From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to music by Philip Glass, one of the founders of what became known as minimalist music. He's the featured composer at this year's Lincoln Center Festival, which begins next week. It will include the premiere of his new opera. On today's Fresh Air, we hear Philip Glass interviewed on stage by his second cousin, Ira Glass, the host of public radio's hit show, This American Life. Ira was just named America's Best Radio Host by Time Magazine. And TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at the latest in reality TV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Former FBI agent Robert Hansen said guilty in a strong voice when asked to enter a plea to espionage charges in federal court today. It was part of a plea bargain that will allow him to avoid the death penalty in exchange for cooperating with authorities who want to know the extent of his spying from Moscow over two decades. He looked pale and thin as he stood wearing a green prison jumpsuit. Hansen's attorney, Plato Shikaris, said the plea agreement is a victory both for his client and the federal government.
The death penalty is no longer an option in this case. And the government receives, as a consequence, the full debriefings from Mr. Hansen as to the breadth of his activities with the Soviet Union.
But Chikaris's characterization of the plea deal as a win-win situation prompted a sharp response from U.S. Attorney Kenneth Melson, who said Hansen is not a winner and never will be a winner.
Hansen will spend the rest of his natural life under the watchful eye of a prison guard. He will have to disgorge all of the money that he received from the Soviets and the Russians for his espionage activity. He will not be able to gain any further from his espionage activity through proceeds from books and other type of articles.
And Melson says if Hansen does not cooperate fully with interrogators, he could still face the death penalty. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been sentenced to 30 days in prison in connection with the protest against Navy bombing exercises on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Kennedy was among some 180 people arrested during military exercises this spring. The environmental lawyer is a nephew of the late President Kennedy. He was represented in federal court today by former New York Governor Mario Cuomo. The trials of two Chinese-born academics with connections to the United States have not yet begun, as was indicated yesterday, but are expected to begin soon. The cases have been a major irritant in relations between the U.S. and China. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
State Department spokesman Richard Boucher yesterday said China had confirmed that U.S. citizen Li Xiaomin and U.S. resident Gao Zhan were on trial. That was news to U.S. embassy officials in Beijing. Today, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Richard Armitage clarified the situation.
I think we had some, bad information. Our information this morning that was briefed to me at the staff meeting is that trial would begin in approximately a week.
State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the misunderstanding was the result of a faulty translation of a Chinese foreign ministry statement. Boucher now says the trial of Li Xiaomin will begin on July 14th in Beijing. He says a U.S. official will be allowed to attend. Boucher says an exact date has not been announced for the trial of Gao Zhan, but is expected to be at about the same time. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street, the Dow was down 227, the Nasdaq down 78. This is NPR News. Two groups of freelance writers have filed lawsuits against the New York Times in the wake of a Supreme Court decision that found that the newspaper infringed on copyrights held by the writers. From New York, NPR's Rick Carr has the story.
Last week, the Supreme Court ruled that The Times and other publishers needed permission from freelance writers and photographers before it could put their articles and photos into electronic databases. Since then, The Times has been removing freelance articles written between 1978 and 95 from those electronic archives. The Authors Guild filed suit on Tuesday seeking damages for the original infringement. The second suit was filed today by the National Writers Union, the group that pressed the Supreme Court case. It alleges that The Times is violating the high court ruling by refusing to commission additional work from writers unless they sign a contract that waives their right to sue for past infringement. A Times spokesperson said today that the paper will talk with lawyers for the freelancers in an attempt to reach an agreement. Rick Carr, NPR News, New York.
The nation's unemployment rate edged up 0.1% in June, erasing the previous month's decline. The Labor Department says most of the job losses last month were in the manufacturing sector. President Bush is celebrating his 55th birthday today as he relaxes with his parents and the First Lady at his parents' oceanfront retreat at Kennebunkport. Mr. Bush and his father went fishing and played a round of golf. Earlier, the president phoned his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. Among the topics they discussed was the administration's missile defense plan. Next weekend, the Pentagon will stage its latest attempt to intercept a long-range missile, a feat often equated by the military with hitting a bullet with a bullet. 2 out of 3 previous tests have failed. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating its 75th anniversary of investing in communities and strengthening people, on the web at mott.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today on our archive edition, we present 2 Glasses in the News. Composer Philip Glass will be the featured composer at the annual Lincoln Center Festival, which begins next week. This week, Ira Glass was named America's Best Radio Host by Time Magazine. Ira is the host of the Peabody Award-winning public radio program This American Life. As David Mamet says in Time Magazine, Ira seems to have reinvented radio. Philip Glass and Ira Glass are second cousins. In 1999, the Field Museum in Chicago asked Ira to interview Philip on stage. We got a copy of this wonderful interview and received the Glass's permission to play it for you. Philip Glass is one of the fathers of minimalist music, although I think he hates the term. He started off writing for his ensemble and went on to write operas, dances, and film scores, including the music for Kundun Koyaanisqatsi, The Thin Blue Line, and The Truman Show. Let's begin with the opening of his recent Symphony No. 5. Music from Philip Glass's Symphony No. 5. And here's Philip Glass interviewed by Ira Glass.
I should say before we start that we barely know each other. We've met long
But we know our relatives.
Yes. We are first cousins once removed, which means that you're my dad's first cousin.
That's right.
And the conversation that we had before this show was just long enough to play some Jewish geography. Uh-huh. To relieve you all of the burden of hearing it. And our families both lived in Baltimore. By the time I was old enough to sort of be awake to anything, you had moved first to Chicago and then here. Then
yeah, I was
then
here
to New York.
I was in Chicago for about 5 years.
Yeah.
52. 52 to 57.
Well, that was before I was born. By the time I was sort of awake enough to know that you existed, you were in New York and then in Paris and then back in New York. Our topic, the topic that we've been given by the museum, is creativity and new directions. And I'd like to start by talking about your musical development, your own musical development, because at the beginning it was very traditional. And I called up my dad and my Uncle Lenny this weekend to ask if they had any special insight into your very early musical career.
What did they say?
They both produced exactly the same memory. Over the phone from opposite sides of the country, and it was you in a band uniform.
Well, I was a flutist, so I taught people to play these little metal flutes.
And what was your repertoire?
Oh, I don't remember. It was just tunes that the bands played. It was just whatever was around. And then we had to have someone to play the Glockenspiel. So after I taught everyone to play the fifes, then I was the leader and I played the Glockenspiel. And then we had the drummer. But that was our way of going to the games. And then after that, I began playing in the school orchestra. You know, and this was actually very important. I realize it in retrospect, because I played in the pit orchestra. The schools in those days, they did little operettas and things of that kind. Gilbert and Sullivan or whatever that might have been. That was a kind of fair that you... But I was playing in the orchestra, and I am convinced that my first contact with theater music was... That was how I... You know, when I would play through these pieces, and I began to understand how scenes worked and how intermissions worked and...
How the music would interweave with the text.
How
the
singers worked with the players, and I did that from a very, very early age. And then years later, when I was writing for opera orchestras, I had a physical memory of being in the orchestra pit. Of course, I was one of the two or three flutists in the orchestra, and seeing the music from that, from being down there.
Yeah. Your father owned a record store. First of all, I've heard that you actually worked in the store sometimes.
Oh, I worked there from the age of 12.
Really?
I worked there until I was in my 20s.
And do you remember what music was playing and what music...
Well, all kinds of music playing. In those days, you could... Those were the old days of 78s, and no one worried about... All the orchestras were scratchy anyway, so you could play anything. So we played music all the time. I eventually became... By 15, I became the classical record buyer for the store. And I learned a lot because I was the one that ordered the records, because my father, Ben Glass, that would have been your great uncle.
Yeah.
He was a self-taught. He knew a lot about music, but he really learned it all by himself. He didn't have a music education background.
Would he play you songs and composers and say, listen to this part, listen to this part?
No, you know what was interesting, Ara, was that... we had a very interesting collection of records at home. His history is actually interesting. This is how it began. He began as an auto mechanic. And then at a certain point in the 1920s and 30s, people started putting radios into cars. And so he began fixing the radios just the same way as he fixed the cars. He learned how to fix radios. Then he got interested in the radios and got rid of the cars and just had a radio shop. Then someone told him that he should sell some records in the radio shop. And gradually, over 10 or 15 years, the record part became bigger and bigger and bigger, and at the end of his life, the radios were just a tiny bench in the back of the store, and he used to fix radios there. So he came to music that way. And then what he had at home, and he didn't know much about music, but he would buy these records and he would take them home. The ones that he couldn't sell, he would take home because he wanted to listen to them to see what was wrong with them. You know, he said, well, there must be something wrong with this music. And he figured, well, if he could figure out what was wrong with it, then he would know what the other... So the music we had at home were like Shostakovich string quartets. We had a lot of modern music that was modern for that time.
And why was Shostakovich not selling in Baltimore?
Well, we're talking about the 1940s.
Yeah.
We're talking about pieces that were new at that time. And the idea of classical music was really the European... 19th Romantic tradition. So anything that was modern at all was had a difficult time. So we had, what we ended up at home with was a collection of very esoteric music. And we would listen to this, what happened is that the more he listened to this music, the more he liked it.
Yeah.
He ended up liking all this strange music that no one else listened to. And then he became an advocate for this music. And I witnessed this many, many times. People would come to the store, and he would try to sell them all this new music. That he said, you know, I bet you never heard this guy Britten. Now, this guy Benjamin Britten is a really terrific composer, and he would practically push these records on people. And he had any number of people in Baltimore whose musical taste was formed by this kind of eccentric. I have to remember these are the days when a record store was very different from. This is before. You had the same Goodies record stores, kind of large and personal. This was a really mom and pop record store. It wasn't very big. This whole stage was probably as big as the whole store.
You must have thought at some point about what your father would think of your music.
Well, He died in a car crash, in an automobile accident, I should say, in the 70s. But he did live long enough to have, I actually saw my records in his store.
So what did he think of it? What did he say about it?
I don't know. I never, you know, it's a funny thing, but I never asked him. It's a funny, I know fathers and sons have all kinds of things that they say or don't say, and I don't know. That was one of the things we never talked about. But I was in the store, and I saw that I looked in the modern music rack, and it was there. But one of the reasons, partly, is that a lot of my orientation to music and my feeling about the way music functions in the world has a lot to do with the fact that I grew up that way.
Hearing new music often.
Well, it's not just hearing the music. I saw how music interacted with people. People would come in. It was a very simple, people came in and they listened to music and they learned by listening and they explored things they didn't know. And it was I witnessed this transaction. Well, I have to tell you the really interesting story. I should tell you what my very first job in the store was. This was a really interesting job. You see, in those days, this is the days of 78, and every record store had what was called, you had an allowance, a return privilege it was called. That was the actual word. It was a return privilege for broken records.
Wait, if you would take the record home and break it,
bring it back? No, it didn't work that way, Aaron. No, if you had the store and some records arrived and they were broken.
Oh, I understand.
So the merchant could return the records. It was called the return privilege, and it was something like, the way they figured it out, they made it something like 5% of the records could be returned.
Right.
Now, what happened was that you didn't actually break 5% of the records, but you could return 5% of the records. So what you had to do, if you wanted to return records and get your money back, you had to break them. That's cute.
So that was your job?
My first job. My brother and I were on the weekends. We went down to the store and we were sent to the basement and we jumped on records.
It's a good preparation for what was to come.
Well, that's a kind way of putting it.
Well, no, no.
So I gradually worked my way, and
classical music.
Didn't matter.
Yeah.
It didn't matter what you broke.
Eddie Fisher.
They counted it by the label.
Right.
And you did it by the company. So there would be companies like OK Records or. Blue Note Records or RCA Records, they all had a return privilege. But the only thing is that all the RCA Records had to be in their box and all the broken OK Records had to be in their box and all the broken Bluebird Records had to be in their box. You couldn't mix boxes. But they didn't really care what was on the record. They just had to be broken. Anyway, so that was my first paid, well, I wasn't actually paid, but that was my first professional job
in
the music world.
We're listening to composer Philip Glass, interviewed by Ira Glass, the host of Public Radio's This American Life. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Ira Glass, the host of This American Life, interviewing his cousin, composer Philip Glass, on stage at Chicago's Field Museum.
Now in 1964, you moved to Paris and you studied with Nadia Boulanger. Could I ask you to talk about what she was like and what you learned from her?
Well, she was, I don't like to talk. Are there any Boulanger students here in the room? I always get into trouble when I talk about it because actually, she wasn't a very nice person. She was a wonderful teacher. She was probably one of the two or three wonderful teachers I've had. I consider Ravi Shankar to have been a wonderful teacher, and I still consider myself a student of his in a way. That we've done records since the days when I worked with him, and about the same time that I was working with Boulanger.
But Boulanger, what was she like? What was it? What would happen?
Well, she was extremely difficult. For example, if you got to the door, I studied. She was on the faculty of the Ecole Normale, but actually, you took lessons at her home. I had three or four lessons a week, one in different subjects, and She gave me enough work. By the way, I went there after I had finished my work at Juilliard. I was 26 or so when I went to Paris. Let me meet one of her older students. She really had younger people. So I went to Paris to study with who was the great master of music technique, of counterpoint, of harmony, of analysis. And she was extremely, demanding. From the first moment you walked in, for example, if you arrived at the door for of the apartment, if you were as much as a minute late, it was better just to go home. Because if you came in late, you got such an abuse. You were criticized on every level of your being and character, and what kind of person are you? You mean coming to just go home, you know? So basically, if the metro was slow that day, if you got off at the wrong stop, anything, you just went home.
And there was something that the students called Black Thursday?
Oh, yes. Something like that? That was a Black Thursday class. That was when she put, we were convinced. Well, I had a private lesson for counterpoint and harmony, and there was a general lesson of analysis that all the students went to, maybe 30 or 40 people. It was not a very large living room that she taught in. And then there was the Black Thursday class, and we were convinced that she put together her eight of her students. She took the four best ones and the four worst ones and put them together.
But you couldn't tell which you were.
We couldn't tell which was which. By the time she got done with us, we were just... those lessons were devastating. Those classes went on for 3 or 4 hours, and they began at 9 o'clock and went to about 1.
Describe a typical exercise.
I'll give you one. There were some very funny... This is one that I was very fond of because it was so... It was so sinister. You walked into the class and into the room, and we were all there, of course, on time, for sure. And on the piano would be just a line of music written in tenor clef, which is not a common clef, but you're supposed to know it. Okay, so first of all, there are 7 clefs. Probably most of you know 2, if you know any. You may 3 clefs, but you're supposed to know 7. And the first thing you do with her is you learned all 7. And she said, Danielle, before we begin the lesson today, would you just play the harmony that goes with this melody? And Danielle would play the first chord, and she says, oh my God, how can you play that chord? And she said, okay, Paul, you play it. So she went through the room until we got the first chord right. Then we did the second chord, the third, the fourth, the fifth, and finally, 3 or 4 hours later, she had beat us into completing this 4-part harmony exactly the way it was supposed to be. And then she said, my dear children, she said, I really didn't expect to spend the day like this because, in fact, I thought you would know this. And she, behind the music rack, she pulled out, it was the second movement of a Beethoven violin piano sonata. And it was, basically, she merely had expected us to replicate exactly the voice leading that Beethoven had done.
From one of the melody lines to recreate the
entire... And she said, of course, if you knew the piece, it would have been easy. Well, she picked something that no one knew. And the fact that we had done it... it was kind of a miracle that we had done it at all. She succeeded, let's put it a different way. She succeeded in eliciting from us the exact voice leading of the original. It took 4 hours.
Do you think that there's a pedagogical efficiency to terror?
You know... I don't know why she was like that, but she was. But I finally, after I'd been there about 2 years, I finally figured out why I was there. It took me so long we were having a lesson, and I had come in with my harmony, and we came to a place in the music, and she said, this is wrong here. And I said, Mademoiselle Boulanger, it's correct. And she said, no, it's wrong. And I said, I cited the rules of voice leading and said, all these things are correct, and there's nothing wrong with this. She said, yes. She said, but if Mozart had done it, she would have done it like this. And she played the correct version, which was that perhaps the soprano was in the third was in the soprano instead of the root of the chord was in whatever I'd done it wrong. And she said, but Mozart would. And then I looked at her and I said, but the rules are right. She said, yes, but it's still wrong. And I was astonished. And it was at that moment that I understood what she was teaching me. And it was very interesting. I realized that she was teaching the relationship between technique and style. And without any doubt, she succeeded. And I realized that what she was telling me then was that the style of Mozart is a special case of technique, that the technique was right, but what made it sound like Mozart was the choices, the predilection that he had to solve the problem in a particular way.
In a different way that the rules would have you solve.
Well, no, he was in the rules too. He followed the rules as well. But she pointed out to me that whenever Mozart was in that situation, he resolved the chord in this way. And even though the rules said it was possible to do it the other way, his particular way, for example, now let's put the question another way. If you listen to, let's say, a measure of Rachmaninoff and in a measure of Bach, you know which is which, immediately. And the question is, well, why do you know that? And the answer is that because they both are following basically the same rules of voice leading for the, but what happens is that you have in the course of your listening, you have taught yourself, you've recognized that Rachmaninoff will always solve a certain problem in a certain way. You may not say that to yourself, but your ear will tell you that. And then Bach will do it in his way. And you say, oh, that sounds like Bach, or that sounds like Rachmaninoff, or that sounds like Stravinsky. And what you're hearing is, let's put it this way, you're hearing the predilection of the composer to resolve a technical problem in a highly personal way. So, in other words, now let's...
And from that point, how hard is it to design your own personal way to solve it?
This is the point. The point is, and this is the other thing which he didn't say in words that day, but which I understood totally, was that in order to arrive at a personal style, you have to have a technique to begin with. In other words, when I say the style is a special case of technique, you have to have the technique. You have to have a place to make the choices from.
Yeah.
If you don't have a basis on which to make the choice, then you don't have a style at all. You have a series of accidents.
We're listening to composer Philip Glass, interviewed by Ira Glass, the host of Public Radio's This American Life. Their talk was recorded in September 1999 at Chicago's Field Museum. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, working with Ravi Shankar, we hear more of Philip Glass's onstage interview with his cousin Ira Glass, the host of Public Radio's This American Life. And David Bianculli takes a look at the latest reality TV shows. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're listening to a unique onstage event, Ira Glass interviewing his second cousin, Philip Glass, on stage at the Field Museum in Chicago. Philip Glass is one of the originators of minimal music. He's the featured composer at this year's Lincoln Center Festival, which begins next week. Ira Glass is the host of the public radio program This American Life. This week, Time magazine named him America's best radio host. The Glass's interview was recorded in 1999.
Talk about your first collaboration with Ravi Shankar, because one of the first times your music took this new direction.
It seemed to me, at that point, it was at the same time I was studying with Boulanger.
And you were hired to transcribe
I was hired to
notate.
He was hired to write music for a film score, and I was hired to be the translator and the notator of the music, and eventually the conductor.
Because they had Western musicians who were supposed to do this.
We had a studio on the Champs-Élysées somewhere, and there were a little orchestra of about 16 French musicians, and they were waiting for their music. And
right, they were supposed to play this Indian music, but they needed somebody to write it down for
exactly.
them.
Exactly. I had to notate the music for them. And, of course, this was the second terrifying experience. The first terrifying experience was being with Nadi Boulanger. The second terrifying experience was being with Ravi Shankar. And these were happening at the same time, by the way, because I was in Paris with Boulanger, and I was also working with Ravi, so I was between the two of these pieces. They scared me to death. I had met Ravi. I had no idea what Indian music sounded like. Don't forget, this is 1963 or 1964. By this time, I was a master's degree graduate from Juilliard, and I'd been studying with Boulanger already for a year. I thought I knew a little bit about music and something. And I listened to this music, I couldn't make heads or tails of it.
What were some of the problems that you found, and what were some of the things that you
learned? Well, the biggest problem was how to organize the music. The pitches weren't that hard to do, because in fact he picked a raga that was easy for us to play in. But figuring out getting the right rhythmic feeling in the music had to do with where, in Western music, you would say where the bar line goes.
Right.
Where the strong beats and the weak beats are, where the rhythmic structure, how that devolved in the music.
So if I picture a piece of music, it's where each measure begins.
Basically.
Yeah.
Of course, this music wasn't written that way. It wasn't written with measures. And when we finally began, we got to the studio that morning, and I said, oh, thank God, we're there 2 hours early. And then we spent 2 hours tuning the tambura, which I ended up playing. And he spent 2 hours teaching me how to be the accompanist, which was fine. And then finally the session started and he began. And so then everybody was sitting, waiting for the music, and Ravi. Then they projected the film. He looked at the picture and he began playing the sitar, and I had to write down what he was playing. Well, the difficulty was writing it down in a notation that would reflect the rhythmic feeling that he was playing. And it took, you know, to be truthful, we solved the problem relatively quickly. Within 3 or 4 hours, I figured out that there were no bar lines. That took me an hour, at least, to figure out to get rid of the bar lines.
So there are no distinct measures?
There weren't any measures. Yeah. I got rid of them entirely.
Just an entire string of...
There were a string of notes. However, I grouped them, and I bracketed them by subgroups of twos and threes and fours. And then I discovered, he never explained this to me, that there was a cycle of beats that kept recurring. And that every time I came to the end of the cycle, the whole thing began again. And then after a while, I realized that the cycles would be divided into either 4-4-4-4, or sometimes 5-5-2-2-2, or sometimes 3-3-3-4-3. All those add up to 16.
Yeah.
So by the afternoon, I realized that the trick of the notation was that every line would add up to 16, and that what I had to do was make sure that I organized the groups of notes in such a way that the accents came in the right places.
And then what did you carry from that into your own composition?
Well, what I was interested was this. What was interesting was I had this the same day that I was doing that, and his tabla player, Alaraca, kept saying to me, I kept making a mess of it. I would write something down, we'd play it, and it didn't sound right. I read it again, it didn't sound right. It was a trial and error. And Alaraca kept saying, all the notes are the same, all the notes are equal. But he kept saying that. I had no idea what he meant. And then finally I realized that in fact it wasn't a question of taking a cycle and dividing it up, it was a question of adding it up. So it was a question of adding instead of dividing. In other words, the cycle consisted of a unit that was added onto each other. And that instead of taking, instead of making a loaf of, slicing a loaf of bread by taking half and quarters and an eighth and so forth. It was by, you would make a loaf of bread by taking a slice and adding another slice and another slice and another slice, and at the end you'd have the whole loaf. It's a very different way of slicing bread.
When you look at the luck.
Did
of,
you get that?
Yes.
Did you all get that? So, but the point was this, that it was a different way of organizing rhythm. And I saw that within a few days of working with Ravi, I understood something which I found completely astonishing, was that music could be organized in a completely different way than what I had taught. And that was, and in fact, then I began listening to other music and I realized that the tradition of Western classical music, or popular music for that matter, was only one description, one way of describing the way music can be organized. And from that moment on, I got interested in music from other parts of the world.
Looking at your career from the outside, one of the things that's striking is the number of different collaborators you've worked with. And I wonder if part of the reason why you do that is because you had this seminal experience of confronting somebody else's
work.
Well,
that's exactly what happens when you find yourself in a place of total ignorance of that kind. And that's a place where you can begin again. You can begin learning again. You know, the difficulty with any, it's not just artists or musicians, but with anybody in any ordinary part of life, or walk of life, the difficulty we have is how do we continue to learn? I mean, everybody has this problem, because you get what we call our training and our education at a certain point, and we spend the rest of our life changing gears in the same way. We're driving that same car, and the car can be a Model T Ford, and you'll drive it all your life. You never learn how to drive anything else. And it's with great effort that you learn to change. And the biggest, this is particularly true of composers, they pick up a style or a way of working a certain way, but the real issue, I've always said to younger composers, it's not how do you find your voice, but how to get rid of it. It's getting the voice isn't hard, it's getting rid of the damn thing. Because once you've got the voice, then you're kind of stuck with it.
You've said to Terry Gross, in fact, she's asked you, do you ever try to compose so it doesn't sound like Philip Glass?
I do it all the time, and I fail all the time. That's really true. I had a wonderful experience when I did my first record for CBS Records, and I did a piece called Opening, and it was for piano. And I sent finished this record, and I sent it up to the Masterworks, and at that time it was still Masterworks. And they called up and they said, well, they didn't want to start, and I started the record with a piano piece, and then the ensemble began playing, and they said, we can't put out the record like this, because no one will know it's you. And that was actually the point. I was trying, I learned that the only hope of shaking free of your own description of music was to place yourself in such an untenable position that you had to figure out something new. That happened with Ravi Shankar in 1964, and I repeated that experience. I do it whenever I can. And that means constantly finding new people to work with. The other thing is that the thing is that as much as I try to do it, how rarely have I actually succeeded. It's very humbling, actually, when you realize how hard it is to break out of your own training. It's very, very difficult.
And how do you feel about that? I mean, is a person only allowed one paradigmatic shift in their lifetime?
How do I think about it? I think it's very difficult. I think that, let me put it this way. If I look at the body of work of the last 30 years, and there are about 30 CDs, and if I look at it that way, and if I take music that I wrote in 1969, let's say, or 1970, like music with changing parts and music into parts, and then I compare it to, I heard you playing a little bit of Dracula, something I wrote last summer. If I listen to those two pieces together, they do sound like they were written by different people, practically. Yeah. And that actually is, but on the other hand, if I look at pieces that were written within 3 or 4 years of each other, I don't hear that. It takes a span of 10 or 15 years for me, because the changes are so incremental that I can't notice them. But I can notice them over 20 or 25 years. I don't notice them over 2 or 3 years.
I have to say, one of the things as a listener that's striking about the newer pieces is that they seem much more romantic and melodic.
Exactly. And you see, it depends where you start. Had I started, perhaps, with the romantic music, I would have ended up writing minimal music. But I started writing minimal music, so I ended up writing romantic music. Basically, whatever I started was, I left that point.
We're listening to composer Philip Glass, interviewed by Ira Glass, the host of public radio's This American Life. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Ira Glass, the host of This American Life, interviewing his cousin, composer Philip Glass, on stage at Chicago's Field Museum.
When you perform a piece over and over again, do you get to a point, you know, like when one buys a record, you know, even a record one loves, or especially a record one loves, you know, you play it over and over and over again in the car and in the house, and it gets to the point where, you know, the songs, it's like gum that's been chewed up. You know, they cease to have flavor.
No, in fact, it doesn't. It works quite a different way. It works quite differently. People like to do the world premiere because they get the glory of the world premiere. But in fact, it, in my view, and I've done this a lot, I've done this numerous times, I consider the first 20 performances just learning the piece. Hmm. And think about it this way. If you think of a pianist who plays a Schubert sonata through his whole lifetime, if you listen to Rubinstein in his later years or Horowitz playing their repertoire later in their life, and you understand the richness with which they play that music and how differently they must have played it when they were younger.
As you go through your tours, do you find yourself falling in love with different sections as it goes on?
We begin to understand the work. And I think it's only after, with a music theater work, I feel it's only after about 20 performances that we really begin to understand what the dynamic structure of the piece is. You know, writing the piece is only one insight into the essence or the quality of the piece. Performing the piece is a whole other way of looking at it. And when the composer is also the performer, he has an opportunity to come to an understanding of his work, which I would say is the only way that he can do it is through performing it.
So performing something like Einstein on the Beach, which you performed throughout all of its early performances and in rehearsals, at the end of that process, what did you see about it? Can it even be named?
For one thing, by the end of the performance, if we could actually play it. I would hate if, I don't know if anyone ever recorded that first night, but I'm sure it was a mess. We could barely play the music, and that's true for a lot of new music.
And in terms of the way that you saw what the music was doing, did you come to understand it differently?
Let's put it this way. In order for musical language, the way we know that it's new is that we have to find a new way of playing it. There's no such thing, this is a little bit similar to what we were talking about before, there's no such thing as a new musical language that you can play the same way. In other words, there's a performance technique that goes with the language. The language comes first because you think it up.
Right.
But the performance technique comes afterwards. And that can take years to develop that.
I've wondered, listening to some of the music, if there are times when you're writing the music and because the music is so complicated and what it's doing in different keys and the way that the rhythms interlace, if there are times when you're writing that you actually aren't exactly sure what it's going to sound like or feel like.
Let me tell you, I just did a piece in Salzburg where Dennis Dussel Davis conducted it, and I finished the piece last January. It was a symphony in 12 movements that's 100 minutes long. It's a rather large piece. It was commissioned for the Millennium. Until the night of the performance, it's not that we didn't know what it sounded like. We could hear what the music sounded like, but we didn't know what it felt like to hear it.
Yeah.
We didn't know what it added up to. I mean, it's like reading the recipe in a cookbook and you still haven't tasted the food.
Are there times when you feel like you've guessed wrong? Where you wrote something?
That's when you do the rewrites, of course, but surprisingly, you'd be surprised. I'm surprised at how little, because very often, and I said to Dennis when I was doing this piece, we just did it about 2 weeks ago in Salzburg, and I said to Dennis that before the performance, with this piece, it's a piece that's 100 minutes long, with a very complicated text, and I said to him, I am working at the limits of what I can conceptualize, and I said, I frankly don't know. I said, I took the music when I got done, and it's in 12 movements. I put the 12 movements on the floor. I made 12 piles of music. You know, so each pile of music was a movement. And I went from movement to movement, trying to listen to the piece to see what... It couldn't fit on the piano. It was 800 pages. I mean, the whole thing was just unreal, you know, trying to figure this thing out. And for me, it was, I guess it would be, let's say, if a sculptor was trying to conceptualize a piece, but you can't walk around the piece all at once. You know, you can only see one part of the piece at a time. And I was having that problem with this piece. I was only able to hear three or four parts at a time, and then I moved on to the next part, and I wasn't familiar enough with the music to be able to hear. By the time it was at part five, I kind of forgot what part two was like. I mean, we're talking about 30 minutes later. And this is, I know this sounds strange to you, but you have to remember.
No, actually, this part of what you're saying is utterly familiar as somebody who makes radio stories. That by the time you work so heavily on any given small section, to get the whole thing, sometimes you have to finish it and then just like listen through it and
leave it for a while in the middle. The first performances, we did get to hear it. Even the first dress rehearsal, we didn't really hear it because the acoustics of the room wasn't good enough. We heard the first dress rehearsal, and by the first night, we really got to hear it.
The theme that we've been presented with is creativity and new directions. And I was wondering...
I didn't know that was a subject. Ara said beforehand, he said, do you want to know what we're talking about? I said, no, well, tell me later. So, are we covering
it? We've done fine, yes.
I said, it won't make any difference if you tell me.
Do you find this to be an enormously open time that is a fertile time for artists who want to do new work and explore new directions?
It depends who you talk to. If you're a producer of operas and films, and if you're involved with productions that involve large amounts of money, it's not a very open time. People are terrified of making multi-million-dollar mistakes in film and in opera and everything, and records, and it's very difficult. If you talk to the people that are making the work, it is very open. And I think what we're all feeling is that that we're coming to there's an exquisite moment that's happening right now, which is that we have the feeling that the whole system of distribution of music and books is going to change. We're talking about, of course, the internet, and of course, when that changes, things that are beginning, it may be that composers will be able to. Certainly they can do it right now. They can make recordings of their work and make it available in a general way, which is not available now. And the kind of openness that you're suggesting, which actually exists, will become apparent.
But even before that, I mean, it's possible for you to tour and do your work and get an audience, even if you're not, I did it with great difficulty
and with relentless energy. And I hardly know anyone else, to be frank, who has done it the way I have. It's extremely difficult. I do about 120 concerts a year.
Is that for business? Is that to keep the work out there? Is that because you love...
It has nothing to do with business, because in fact, I could stop working right now. It has to do with understanding what the nature of music is. It's only through the constant, for me, immersion in the process of creating and recreating music that I begin to understand what music is really about. I'm really talking about what the essential nature of music is. And I find that the experience of performing music in front of people, it is the essential experience for the composer. It's at that moment when the whole, let's say, transaction of music, when we see it clearly what it is, that it's not a conceptual activity. It's not, music doesn't exist in a library, it exists in the air. It exists as something we hear. When someone, if you go to a library and see hundreds of scores, and you're not actually looking at music. You're looking at notation of music. You know, the actual music exists when you play it. John Cage was a very important part of, I knew him quite well, and being around him and Morris and people like that, and they were very aware of the fact that that art exists as a transaction between people.
Yeah.
That music is a kind of a sublime currency that's passed among people. And perhaps the most sublime that you can imagine, perhaps poetry or whatever you might say, you might have your own favorites, but for me, it's, of course, it's music. So the point of performing is to reaffirm the essential characteristic of music, which is that it is, as I say, it's a sublime currency that is passed between people.
Composer Philip Glass, interviewed by his cousin Ira Glass, host and producer of the public radio program This American Life, which originates at WBEZ in Chicago. Their interview was recorded in September 1999 at Chicago's Field Museum. Our thanks to recording engineer Mary Gaffney, WBEZ, the Field Museum, and of course Philip Glass and Ira Glass. Philip Glass is the featured composer at the annual Lincoln Center Festival, which begins next week. Ira Glass was just named America's Best Radio Host by Time Magazine. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on the latest in reality TV. This is Fresh Air. Last night, CBS presented the second season premiere of Big Brother, in a season that already has seen the arrival of such so-called reality shows as Spy TV and Fear Factor. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The only way to get through this stretch of awful reality shows is to remember the 1950s. When Gunsmoke came along, it was as big and influential a hit as Survivor is today. Every network wanted to cash in on the Western craze and came up with all sorts of usually unimaginative variations on the formula. By 1959, there were 31 Westerns playing each week in primetime. That astounds me. Yet the Western on TV is dead now, so there's hope. Meanwhile, my advice is to pass on most of what's being offered by the networks in the reality genre these days. And that definitely includes Big Brother 2. Last year's version of this show was so dull and awful, CBS hired a new executive producer. The guy they hired is Arnold Shapiro, who, more than 20 years ago, was responsible for one of the first and best entries in the reality TV genre. He did Scared Straight, that tough-talking documentary about prison lifers scaring wayward teens into giving up their bad habits. These days, there ought to be a Scared Straight program for TV executives. Big Brother 2 is an improvement on the original, but not in any way that justifies watching it. Locking a dozen people into a house filled with cameras and microphones and having them vote each other out until one is left to win a prize isn't necessarily an awful idea, but in this case, it is. When MTV's The Real World takes a voyeuristic peek at its dissimilar roommates, the clashes count for something. In the current New York version, the opener had a white kid from Ohio offending a black woman from California with his racial stereotyping. But by the end of the episode, he changed his views and apologized. Big Brother 2 isn't looking for reconciliation, just for controversy. So when it has a middle-aged guy from Tennessee talking to the camera about what he finds offensive about gay men and women, the show gleefully captures him talking to Bunky, who's admitted his homosexuality to the camera, but not yet to his housemates.
And I was like, geez, you know, Justin, you scared me of that gay thing. I cannot imagine that you're gay. And he was kidding, of course, but we were all kind of searching for the gay guy. It's deviant, it's perverse, and it's a lifestyle that 90% of Americans don't want anywhere near their families or themselves. I want to be with people I'm comfortable with. I'm comfortable with you. Gosh, Bunky is a super sweet guy.
I'm all about respect, you know
exactly.
What I'm saying?
Don't
push it on me.
Don't.
Whatever it is.
You know, it used to be sickos, weirdos, and freaks. Now it's alternative lifestyle. And it's not cool to not think that's cool. But don't come throw it in my face and try to tell me it's normal. I think he's honest and sincere. He and I are going to hook up, okay?
You and Justin?
Justin.
What do you mean hook up?
In terms of I'm never, ever going to nominate him. And he's never, ever, ever going to nominate me, okay? Let's the four of us, or the five of us, make a pact right now, an alliance, if you will, to say, look, Let's try to win every damn head of household we can and get rid of everybody else in this house except us four. And let's go to the very end with this thing.
And he said he'll never vote for me. I'm like, yeah, wait till you find out I'm gay. Then you might vote for me.
Hey, but let me ask you something.
Julie Chen hosts and is just as terrible as she was last year. There's no reason to watch this show. Just as there's no reason to watch Spy TV, a mean-spirited candid camera, or Fear Factor, a mean-spirited boot camp. But there is one new reality series that's not only watchable, but wonderful. It starts Sunday night on BBC America, and it's called Celebrity Castaway. In each show, a normally pampered star is sent to some remote location for a week or so, armed with a video cam, and left to fend for himself or herself. The opener features Billy Connolly, the Scottish star of Head of the Class, who spends 10 days dressed in sealskins and camping at the Arctic Circle.
This is my fourth night. So after tonight, I have two nights, and then I get to sleep in a bed again. And I get to wash. I don't want to wash again. I haven't washed since 5 days ago. I've got the same underwear and socks and all that on. And I must say it feels pretty damn okay to me. I smell really peculiar because I don't have that much BO, incidentally, but because it's not, you know. I do. Yeah, that was a lie. I've got a pullover in my bag that would frighten the dogs.
This makes for a very chilly Billy, but also for some delightfully different television. It's one reality series you shouldn't miss, out of about 15 that you should.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Louis Armstrong's recording Sugarfoot Strut. He died 30 years ago today.
I'm Sugarfoot Strut, just let me warn you, Sugarfoot Strut, let me afford you, dancing this tree, down where the sweet yams grow, sweet and low, ginger cake soup, brownies the cookie, Dinka Jones too, even and Sookie, form in a ring, holler and sing, let's go. Yams are for young and old, but dig them up cold, the ladder I'm rolling the coal. From is the side, good as the bodies and so whole, babe. Cinnamon roll, black as old Joe, brown is what Sam is, yellow is close, the gold is what Yam is, so trouble tut tut, let's do the Sugarfoot Strut.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Kissing in Manhattan, a work of fiction by David Schickler. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with historian Jay Winnick about his bestseller, April 1865. It's about the end of the American Civil War. Also, we meet journalist Andrew Croma, who founded a radio station in his country, Sierra Leone, during its civil war. The station has been attacked. He's been abducted. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.